Welcome to Couples Therapy in 7 Words. I am your co-host, Judy Alexander, and I'm here with my husband, Dr. Bruce Chalmer.
Hello, Judy, and hello, listeners. And we have yet another wonderful interview lined up today. This is an interview with Dr. Carl Pillemer, who's going to be talking about family estrangement based on his very recently published book called Fault Lines. And I think you're going to have a great time listening to that interview. We've already done it, and it was just really delightful. So this podcast, of course, is called Couples Therapy in 7 Words, and we'd like you to comment and rate us on iTunes, Spotify, wherever you get your podcast from, and let people know about it. And Judy, why don't you tell folks what the 7 words are?
The 7 words are be kind, don't panic, and have faith.
And that's the formula that I used to organize my book, which we're also letting you know about today. My book is called Reigniting the Spark, Why Stable Relationships Lose Intimacy and How to Get It Back. And I thought what we would do today is let you in on some of the wonderful reviews the book has been getting. It's really kind of cool as an author when, you know, these folks that I don't know read the book and say all kinds of nice things about it. So, Judy, why don't you give one example of one of the reviews?
Okay. Reading this book is like breathing fresh Vermont air, refreshing, inspiring, down to earth, and filled with grounded wisdom that emerges from decades of practice as a therapist with hundreds of couples. I am especially inspired by his willingness to bring spiritual lives, religious and non-religious, into the conversation, exploring with couples what matters most to each of them while dealing with life's inevitable uncertainties and struggles.
And here's another one that, for reasons will be obvious, is absolutely one of my favorite reviews.
This book will make a great book club book pick. Many discussion points and relatable at any age and years married. Definitely a recommended read.
So we hope you will go and get a hold of the book, Reigniting the Spark, Why Stable Relationships Lose Intimacy and How to Get It Back. You can get it at Amazon or Barnes & Noble or your favorite bookstore, or you can go to brucechalmer.com and you will see there are some links there which will take you right to the page where you can get the book. It's available on paper. It's available as an ebook. It's available as an audiobook. So get a hold of the book and read it, and then maybe you can do a review too, and we'll quote you on this program. So the next thing you're going to hear, we're going to go to our interview with Dr. Pillemer. You'll hear Judy introducing him, and then we'll get into the interview. And so I hope you enjoy the interview.
Our guest today is Carl Pillemer, PhD. Dr. Pillemer is a professor of human development at Cornell University. A family sociologist and gerontologist, Dr. Pillemer is the founder of the Cornell Estrangement and Reconciliation Project, in which over 1,600 individuals have been surveyed regarding their experiences of family rifts and ways to overcome them. His most recent book is Fault Lines, Fractured Families and How to Mend Them, published by Avery in 2020. His two earlier books share older people's advice for living, 30 Lessons for Loving, The Wisest American's Advice on Love, Marriage, and Relationships, and 30 Lessons for Living, Tried and True Advice from the Wisest Americans. Dr. Pillemer writes and speaks extensively about family relationships, marriage, and elder wisdom. Carl, welcome to Couples Therapy in 7 Words.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here with you, and thanks for having me on the podcast.
Oh, we're thrilled. So for starters, let's tell our listeners what we're talking about when we refer to family estrangement. What sort of situations are you referring to?
Well, that's a great question, because it's actually been a little bit of a confusion in the research literature on this topic. One thing I learned, by the way, when I got interested in this topic 5 years ago, was how little research had actually been done, only maybe a dozen published articles on a phenomenon that's so far reaching and affects so many people. So in that literature, and also in the clinical literature, there are different definitions. In some cases, people might talk about emotional estrangement, for example, where two people are still in touch with one another or have contact, but there's a very powerful emotional distance. I approach this, and my research team approach this differently. When I look at estrangement, I mean a situation in which contact has fundamentally ceased between two people. So that even in this hyper-connected society, as much as you can not be connected to someone who occurs, you know, putting it in simple terms, it's when a family member says, I'm done, and really refuses to be contacted or refuses to have contact with another person. Now, we included people in these studies who may have seen someone across the room at a family event or might be included on an email chain. But the way we looked at it across all studies is we asked people, is there someone in your family from whom you are estranged? That is, with whom you have no contact at all at this time. So we took a more extreme view, and I can tell you why, you know, that is probably later on in this podcast, because I think it's an important distinction from some other research.
Yeah, indeed. You know, I don't know how much we're going to get into the weeds, so to speak, about Bowen family systems. I have some familiarity with that through my own work, and it's interesting, the emotional estrangement idea. You know, when you're doing the genograms in a Bowen context, you draw the little wavy lines to indicate a sort of emotional estrangement. It may not necessarily be estrangement the way you're describing it. Am I understanding that distinction as you understand it?
Yes, you know, I'd love to come back to Bowen theory as well, because as you point out, and especially if you have listeners who aren't familiar with it, it is the one school of family therapy or family counseling that explicitly deals with issues of estrangement. I was fascinated to find that if you look in the index of the enormous handbook of family therapy, there's no entry on estrangement. So it's usually not treated as a separate problem, or as they call it in Bowen theory, cutoff. So I think that the work that occurs in Bowen theory on this topic is astonishingly good and has influenced my own viewpoint. But yes, in terms of the way they consider it, their notion of cutoff in Bowen theory is larger in the sense that they also apply it to emotional cutoff. I believe, and that's based on the research and talking to clinicians, but talking to many, many people who have been in family estrangements or have reconciled, that there's something qualitatively different between a distant relationship or a conflictual relationship with someone when contact is still occurring. So when there is a relationship that is still maintained. That really is quite different from when someone in a close family relationship has entirely cut it off. So there's no further progression, no growth in the relationship, nothing else happening. I really believe it's a separate occurrence, a separate kind of a phenomenon that affects people differently from just an unhappy family relationship and needs to be studied and also intervened in probably as a separate and unique phenomenon.
You know, it's interesting you point that out. And again, I'm foreshadowing a little bit some of what we'll talk about later, because that distinction you just made, I think, is really crucial when we come around to reconciliation. But let's get back to that. Let's stay with just the notion of estrangement for now, but we're going to be coming back around to that.
Yeah, how did you get interested in studying family estrangement?
You know, that's a great question, and I often get asked that. I'd say there are two reasons. One's long-term, and one was one of those flashes of inspiration that you occasionally get as a researcher. The long-term view is I've been interested for 30 years in both the light and the dark side of families. So I've done many studies on more positive things, like how family members offer support to one another, how people provide care for family members. But I've also been interested in things like conflict, parental favoritism among adults. So how do older parents show favoritism among their children? I've looked at conflict among siblings. I've even done a lot of research on domestic violence, say, as it affects older people. So I've always have had an interest in the stressful and difficult sides of families. And that's one, I think, sort of a context in which I became interested in estrangement. But where I really got the idea was for my first book, which doesn't sound like it has much to do with this. I interviewed over 1,200 older people to get their advice for living. So if you ask very old people, what would you like to pass on to younger people? What lessons have you learned that you think younger people would benefit from? Mm-hmm. I asked a whole lot of them that question, which no one had done before. And one question was about the regrets that older people have. So I would ask them, well, how can someone get to your age without having regrets? Now, the first thing I'll say is a lot of them believe that if you get to 80 or 90 with no regrets at all, you probably haven't led that interesting a life.
That's you haven't been trying.
Yeah, I mean, you know, they. But in general, how do you avoid major regrets? And I was astonished at how many very old people regretted and how intensely they regretted an unresolved family estrangement.
Yeah.
So I expected to hear more about bad business deals or affairs in marriage. And I heard more often than I ever expected older people, you know, breaking into tears about the son or brother or even their own parent long ago, but with whom they had never reconciled. And now it was too late. And that got me really interested in the topic. I was surprised at how frequently it occurred. And I was surprised at how intensely emotionally painful it was for people. And third, how shameful many of them found it, how often this was the first time they had discussed it in years with a stranger who was coming in from the outside. And I found all of those confirmed as I began to study it. But I began to look into it then and found that there was lots of anecdotal evidence and clinical evidence that estrangement was very prevalent and almost no research. So I did ask myself, I asked myself, what's this all about, that there's this enormous problem that causes so much pain and no one's studying it? So I felt it was my duty. It was fascinating.
That's a great segue into actually what our next question here. You know, your research, and this is really kind of a mind-boggling number, your research showed over a quarter of Americans reported, you know, I could imagine a quarter of Americans having experienced estrangement, but your research was they were currently estranged, which really just blew me away. I have to tell you, I used to be a statistician back in the day before I was a psychologist. And so I was, you know, my old nerd self. I'm kind of a recovering nerd myself. And I went back and read your appendix, of course. And I was fascinated by your methodology, you know, that you came up with a really good representative sample. So a quarter of Americans currently estranged. And this is sort of leading into some of the topics of your book, and I'll just invite you to talk about, you identified some patterns in the hundreds of stories you heard about how estrangement takes place. So could you tell us, like, what are some of the main causes of estrangement?
Sure. Let me comment briefly on how extensive estrangement is. I was really surprised that fully a quarter of people said that they had an estrangement going on in their family. And I will say that it wasn't just one survey. I was able to replicate this in a couple of other ways, and it really holds up. That certainly a fifth of Americans, and probably closer to a quarter, are estranged from someone in their either immediate or extended family. So it is strikingly common, and it's particularly surprising then how much people in estrangements feel deeply and truly alone. Very few of them talk to anyone else about it. They find it embarrassing and shameful. So one thing I hoped to do in the book was to reveal, hey, you're not alone. There are lots of people in this situation. In terms of patterns, we found six major patterns, six ways in which people move towards estrangement in families. And very briefly, one of those we called the long arm of the past, namely, aversive childhood experiences, harsh parenting, extreme childhood difficulties. Even if those get resolved more as people become adults, there are some people who can't move beyond those. We found that the legacy of divorce, with the frequent alienation of children or of one of the parents, was also a very strong causal factor. A third one, which I'm sure you've seen and many people have seen, we call it the problematic in-law. So there are a number of estrangements that result from a person being perceived as marrying the wrong person, or a controlling or difficult spouse who pulls the person away from their a family of origin. A fourth area, I would say, money may not be the root of all evil, but it is indeed the root of many estrangements.
Oh,
so
yeah.
We found that conflicts over money, inheritance, business, wills, was a common pathway. A fifth pathway, I would say, is expectations, violating someone's expectations,
mm-hmm.
ranging from a good example is when mom gets sick and the siblings really disagree on who should be providing care. Mm-hmm. Daughter expects her brothers to help, but brothers don't, and it creates a rift. And the final one is one I'd like to touch on because I think it's really, really important. And other research has shown the same thing, that if you look at the heart of a lot of estrangements, it does come down to a person's sense of their core values being violated, that it's not simply arguments or personalities, but the other person has done something that shows they are fundamentally dissimilar in terms of values. They may adopt a controversial lifestyle choice, or as we're seeing now, possibly a political viewpoint.
Yeah.
That's been big this year. Yes, I hear it in the office.
But we know from social science research that in relationships in general, like attracts like. We like people who are similar to us, and in particular, people who share our values. And that's true in families as well. And sometimes the bonds of attachment and loyalty can overcome a situation where people really see the world in such a fundamentally different way. And so those were the factors. And I think, as you can imagine, as therapists, breakdowns in communication characterize all of these, where, you know, stonewalling eventually occurs and communication breaks off.
Mm-hmm.
But I would say those are the core six types or pathways to estrangement that we encountered. And in many cases, people experience more than one of those.
Oh, sure.
Yeah. Well, you know, in the book, you describe how your original focus on estrangement broadened into a study of how reconciliation happens. Can you tell us about how that came about?
Sure, if I can tell a brief, you know, anecdote.
Sure.
I started out this research as a study of estrangement. So I looked for people who were estranged, and, you know, that was a huge effort because there's no database of estranged people. And by the time I'd gotten through maybe a year of that, I myself was becoming depressed and disheartened. People
yeah.
seemed to be in these intractable relationships. Or excuse me, intractable non-relationships. Then people began to drift into the study who had been estranged and had reconciled. And that was like a light bulb going off. So I spared no time or expense to reach around 100 people with whom we did in-depth interviews. So it's the largest study of its kind, who had been estranged often for years or decades and who had managed to reconcile. And their stories were in some ways incredibly similar in terms of how the estrangement occurred and how bad it was. They weren't in easier situations, but this experience of reconciliation for them was simply transformative, even if the resulting relationship wasn't terrific.
Mm-hmm.
Going through the process of reconciliation was so important for them that even though I'm not supposed to have such clear opinions as a social scientist, I will say I became kind of a reconciliation advocate. I really feel that it's achievable in many families and that for the people who affected it, it was more than just restoring a relationship. It was a transformative life experience.
Mm-hmm.
I want to tell you, I've been recommending your book to folks I work with. And it's interesting to me, as I read the book, and you know, as I say, I've been recommending it to folks. Of course, I've been recommending it to some folks who are dealing with exactly the kind of situations you're describing. But I'll tell you another parallel that occurred to me as I was reading it. You know, you talk about the effects of divorce as one of the pathways to estrangement, particularly if, you know, children take sides with one parent and cut off contact with the other, the, you know, alienation kind of thing. But it also occurred to me that divorce itself is a quintessential example of estrangement between family members, you know, between the two divorcing spouses. They used to consider themselves kin, and then they break that kinship. And As I read your description, and I got to say, you are an advocate there, and I understand that you weren't just being a researcher; you were also being an advocate because you see the benefit of so many people describing this. When you described how the reconcilers you interviewed managed to find a way to get past the estrangement with parents or children or siblings, I actually saw a lot of parallels to how I work with couples who are trying to recover from some kind of breach, like infidelity or something like that. Did you hear stories of people reconciling after divorce? Did that come up? Because I'm imagining the way you've defined estrangement, people wouldn't necessarily think of divorce that way. You know, that feels like, well, that's kind of optional, so you can do that. You can't really divorce your parents even if you cut off contact, or at least rarely. But, you know, people, someone you've chosen to marry, you can choose to divorce. So maybe people don't think of that as estrangement. But I saw a lot of parallels. You know, the stuff that reconcilers talked about, I fit into my language. This podcast is Couples Therapy in 7 Words, and the 7 words are be kind, don't panic, and have faith. What I talk about as faith, not necessarily in a religious sense, has a lot to do with that notion of acceptance that you described, the notion of accepting people as they are and working with it, rather than insisting that, you know, your whatever your expectations or values are set in concrete. Have you heard stories of people reconciling after divorce? Have you seen that parallel in your own work?
Ah, Bruce, if only we had an extra hour or two, because you really raised a number of really critical and important points there. And let me respond to them. I don't know if this is in exact order. First of all, although I didn't look at divorce, and the main reason why in this book we didn't is there's an enormous research literature on divorce and divorcing couples and what leads to it, and you know, all kinds of clinical and social science advice. So it really felt that was beyond the scope of a book like this. Mm-hmm. But I did rely, as you know from reading the book, on the work of people like John Gottman.
Absolutely, yeah.
Where the sort of cascade of negative events, where disagreements and difficulties eventually lead to contempt and stonewalling, to use mm-hmm. his terms, that same kind of a cascade and same kind of a pattern characterizes these relationships. One of the things about it, and I would be curious as to what you think, and I hadn't really thought about this before until you asked that question. In a divorce, there's a legal event which ends the relationship. So even though the person may have ambivalent feelings, there's a sense of when it's over. What the experience is for people in these other family relationships, say with a child or a parent or a sibling, is this overwhelming sense of ambiguity. It's an ambiguous loss. There's no cutoff. I had a number of people say to me, it's the end of a relationship, but with no divorce or no funeral. It just sort of ends, but it's still there. So in estrangement, I'm sure you have this in divorce too, but in estrangement, you have the continual possibility that the relationship could reopen. Mm-hmm. And you have someone who is psychologically present, but physically absent.
Yeah.
And that really characterizes these relationships. They're never over in the way that a divorce is over, because we don't have a way to do that with the, you know, but with the uncle you've been close to, and then he does something awful and, you know, you never want to see him again for a while. So I think the analogy to marriage and divorce is definitely there, in the sense of there's a buildup to it, there's a breakdown in communication, issues happen, and people decide to split. But there's an ongoing sense with estrangements that it's never over. And in our society, again, I'd be curious as to what you think. There, because divorce now is so accepted and so ubiquitous, people are less ashamed of saying I'm divorced than mm-hmm. they are for saying, I haven't seen my son for 5 years and I don't know why.
Yeah.
There's almost invariably a thought bubble. And I've made the mistake of it myself, even as somebody who's had, you know, short-term family estrangements, of wondering what's wrong with you. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But what did you do wrong? Yeah. It's almost involuntary. I do want to say one more thing. Even though I don't think that divorce is really analogous to these other kinds of family estrangement, I will say, in line with the theme of your work, estrangements profoundly affect marital relationships.
Mm.
It's a kind of, as I call in the book, collateral damage, where let's say the husband is involved in this conflict with all of his siblings around the dispersal of a family business. And every day the wife hears about it again, and here's what his brothers did again today. And there's no real way to win, especially if the spouse, you know, has a more sort of neutral attitude. Mm-hmm. So there are relationships where estrangement provides a kind of a contagion of stress.
Oh, absolutely.
Marital and couple or partner relationships that I did find has quite a significant effect. And since some of these estrangements persist over a very long time, it can definitely have an impact in couples. I don't know whether you've seen that, but it certainly came up in these interviews.
Oh, it's funny you mentioned that. I want to comment on the distinction you made about marriage having the possibility of an ending in divorce, you know, a definite ending. I think that's right on. I do see that. It's actually interesting. I think that's one of the reasons why marriage is such a different thing from merely, as if it's a small thing, merely loving and being committed and, you know, and being faithful and all that kind of stuff. That's all important stuff. But marriage itself does provide, marriage invites in more than just the couple. And divorce has that effect as well. Divorce provides something that says, okay, in the eyes of everyone now, at least we have an unambiguous break here. And I think you're absolutely right. When you have an estrangement that doesn't have something like that, it's much more difficult. It's interesting. It's funny you should mention the effect of divorce on families. One of the things we do in these podcasts, and so we're going to segue to that now, is we take a listener question, often get these via my blog or other sources, and we like to just put it out there and invite you to comment on it. And as you will hear when we do this question, it's exactly what you're talking about. So I'll turn it over to Judy and she'll give us the question.
Okay, so Carl, here goes. Tammy writes, "My husband, I'll call him Fred, and I have been married for 15 years and we have 3 school-age kids. We live pretty close to both sets of our parents. Fred never really clicked with my parents, but it didn't seem to be too much of a problem. But about 4 years ago, Fred got into an argument with my dad when we were visiting my parents, and they both said some pretty horrible things to each other. Fred said he's done with them. He said he wouldn't object to my seeing them or taking the kids to see them, but he wouldn't let them come to our house anymore. At first, I supported my husband in this. My dad can be pretty nasty sometimes. But any time I'd have contact with my parents, it would cause tension between me and Fred. It's like I was being disloyal to Fred by wanting to still have a relationship with my parents. A couple of weeks ago, I found out my dad has cancer, and I decided I want to be able to have my parents come to our house. Fred said my dad has to apologize first before he'll let that happen. I don't want to lose my marriage, but I can't keep this up. What can I do?" So we turn it over to the expert here. That's you, Carl.
That's a great question. And let me remind your listener that, and I say this to everyone, that I know about this kind of stuff as a researcher rather than as a clinician. So I would hope that somebody in a challenging situation like that, one of the first and foremost things that people who have reconciled suggest is definitely go talk to someone about it. Mm. Find someone, even if your husband won't go, find a professional with whom you can talk about this kind of thing. I don't want to seem like I'm doing a plug for Bruce, what you may do for a living, but really almost invariably people who had resolved these kinds of things had gone to some kind of a counselor and gotten that kind of objective feedback and support through it.
I know you mentioned that in the book. You have a section in the book where you describe exactly that as one of the important features of people who have reconciled. They've got professional help. And I did notice
that.
Right,
and one barrier to that, I also did a survey of 60 marriage and family therapists. So just like a random sample-ish kind of survey, asking them what they do. And one of the big barriers people tend to feel is it doesn't do me any good if I go in alone. Mm. You know, I need either my husband or I need the estranged person. I've come to conclude that that is not true, that there are lots of people for whom individual counseling for how they can handle a situation like that is really, really valuable. And someone in the Bowen theory tradition, for example, it's great for people, or a family therapist who has some experience with this.
And I notice you also said it doesn't have to be, sometimes does not have to be a long drawn out counseling. It could be helpful to have short-term counseling to help clarify your feelings and understand the situation and give it a more objective view.
Yes, I'm exactly right, because these things cut to our core. Your listener's question is complex, because there would be more direct advice if her husband were saying, how do I deal with this? If her husband were coming to me and saying, how do I deal with this? I would say that if there's one thing the people in our studies agree, is this idea of waiting for someone to apologize, of blackmailing them into an apology, is just a no, is almost a useless strategy. And if you think about it logically, why would a forced apology do you any good?
Yeah.
And very often in the cases I study, the relationship starts again and the person then apologizes because they feel badly about it. Mm-hmm. So one of the strongest pieces of advice is give up on the concept of an apology as the precondition for getting back together. If you sit and think it out, it's not really going to do you any good. And it's not what's needed. And the other person has exactly the same hardened viewpoint. This is what people told me again and again, especially in families where I interviewed both people. The person on the other side has exactly the same criterion that you ought to be apologizing to me. So one thing that has to happen in that family, I think, is, as I say in the book, abandoning the apology as a precondition. That's one thing. Second, I think that if I were talking to the husband, I'd say, one reason why you need to do this has nothing to do with your feelings towards the parents. It's your feelings towards the spouse. So very often we put up with, and this is from other studies we've done as well, we put up with difficult in-laws, not because we like the in-laws, but because we care about our partner. And there's so little investment in the occasional visit or being with them that it makes much more sense absolutely to allow that kind of limited contact and just deal with your own emotional reactivity. So I think that that's another piece. That would be pretty clear. I would argue to that husband that this really doesn't make sense, and that well over 100 people who've reconciled would say that what you're doing is simply not worth it for any reason. There's no principle to stand on, unless this were like a violent or dangerous situation. Helping it to facilitate your partner's contact with her parents at the end of their life, if one doesn't do that, it's something one is extremely likely to regret later on.
Yes.
So that would be easier. For the spouse, though, is it Tammy?
Tammy, yes. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, that is a much more challenging, aspect of it. I think that the anticipated regret of not being part of your own family probably overcomes and overwhelms this sort of loyalty to the spouse, which is objectively an unreasonable demand. It's not something that should happen. It most often happens in the other direction. Parents don't like the son-in-law or the daughter-in-law, and they demand loyalty to the family of origin. And based on this and a number of other studies, I can say you're always going to lose with that bet.
Yeah.
It's almost never going to occur for a parent that their kid is going to say, yeah, I was wrong to marry this person. I'm just going to go hang out with you. So in the reverse order, I'd say that's almost an iron law. In this case, though, and I'd be interested in your viewpoint, it's hard for me to think of how this would resolve without Tammy spending some time with an objective trained person. And developing strategies for dealing with it. I mean, if I were, what I would say to her husband, to Fred, is abandon this apology notion. It's such a small investment to have some relationship with people that everybody in our studies who took that step and did a modest, if not a reconciliation, reestablished contact, there was no one who regretted it.
Yeah, it is interesting. The part about people's narratives hardening, of course, I see all the time in a clinical setting. And I'll tell you something I always find fascinating, and this is going back to your noting in your research that never mind the apology, just establish contact. That is so crucial. What I find is if people are willing to, and my buzzwords around this are tolerating the anxiety, which is also something out of Bowen, actually, mm-hmm. come to think of it. I'm not an Orthodox Bowenian, but I've learned from their stuff.
Same here.
Tolerating the anxiety is crucial for any kind of intimacy, by which I simply mean showing up and being willing to hear what the other person is saying and being honest yourself. And when people do that, not to border on the mystical here, but when people are actually in intimate communication, they are now thinking with not just their own minds, they're thinking with a joint mind. They think thoughts they wouldn't have thought. You know, things start to look different. You know, intimacy is where the energy for growth happens. And so if they can actually establish contact without preconditions like that, it's unpredictable what will happen. And often what happens is exactly what you saw among your reconcilers. And, you know, those stories you told and the one you just mentioned about folks who get back in contact and without insisting on an apology, and then they get a sincere apology that actually has to do with what they're worried about.
Well, Bruce, actually, you've made me think of something, and there's something else I think I would say to Fred or to people like Fred, that the reason why he would do it, the reason why I would argue that he probably should do it, is not at all for his in-laws or even for his wife. One of the major insights I learned from these extensive interviews with people who reconciled is about 100% of them, if you ask them, why did you reconcile after 10, 20, 30 years, they invariably said, I didn't really care that much about how the other person felt. I did it for me. Mm-hmm. It was, they'd said, the reason why I reconciled was I did it for myself. I got this issue off the table. I got it out of the back of my mind. As one man said who reconciled with his brother, he said, you know, the following day I woke up and thought, wow, it's not in the back of my mind anymore that I mm-hmm. haven't talked to my brother for 25 years.
Yeah, that takes me to a quote that you have in your book where you say reconciliation can be a powerful engine for personal growth. I love that.
You know, that was one of the most surprising findings of the book. And first time I heard it, second time, third time, fourth time, I then ceased to be surprised by it, that almost invariably, people felt that affecting a difficult reconciliation was like any other major life challenge that you overcome, and then you feel really good about it. I say in the book, it's a little like the concept of a discipline, like running a marathon or learning mm-hmm. how to play the guitar. You succeed and you fail and you succeed and you fail and you keep at it and you get better at it. That was really the sense of them. Over and over, they said, being able to get through this, I got counseling, I got back in touch. It was the hardest thing I ever did. It's not great now, but I feel like I can accomplish many other things by doing it. So I would say to a friend, if you can get yourself through this effective, be generous, make your wife's life easier. The degree to which you then stop thinking about it, stop holding on to it, was so dramatic in the lives of these folks that, and again, it's not like the resulting relationship was perfect. You know, the father, in some cases, continued to push buttons and made life difficult, but it was this sense of personal well-being and effectiveness at not having this cutoff exist anymore. I don't know whether you folks see that in your work, but I got sold on it because of how much better they felt about themselves and the world in which they were living when they'd gotten out of one of these estrangements.
Oh, yeah. I see it all the time. And, you know, actually in my book, I have a whole chapter on forgiveness, which is a lot about that, really. My definition of forgiveness is really very similar to what you're describing. I'm not talking about saying that what the other person did was fine. It has nothing to do with that. The first person to forgive is yourself for letting yourself be in the situation. And then you can easily forgive other people because they're doing the best they could too. It's about that sense of acceptance. And then you can let go of the anger. And it's an immediate sense of relief. And it has nothing to do, oddly enough. You can forgive people that you still maintain a restraining order on. You know, you don't have to be angry at them. It doesn't mean that you're going to trust them necessarily, but you can actually let go of that anger. And I think reconciliation is a lot about that.
But Bruce, so you've led me to think, if I could pop in up with one more thought, because I think it's really important in this context of the example. One thing which a person like Fred really could do, and again, it's one of the strongest pieces of advice, is this notion in a family estrangement of offering one last chance under highly specific conditions. So one of the most concrete things was, so someone like in a situation like that thinks, I've tried five times before, it never gets any better, I'm not going to do it again. And what the people who successfully reconciled said is try one more time and make it explicitly clear what has to happen in order for contact to resume. Also, one might say to one's father, for example, Tammy might say to her father, listen, I'd like you to be able to come, but you cannot criticize Fred during that time. If that happens, I'm going to ask you to leave, or we're going to leave. Not people, when they try to reconcile, often keep these boundaries amorphous, like let's all try to get along. And a father may not see being critical or spouting obnoxious political opinions as not getting along. It has to be almost in highly specific behavioral terms. I'm going to try again. You can come over. If X happens, you will have to leave, and then this won't happen again. And a surprising number of people, but when offered a clear last chance, took it. And many of the reconcilers realized, hey, this person was probably able to do that all along. So I would say, in that case, if they could try it and set highly specific terms, often they say, if somebody's asking to get back in, a powerful piece of advice was say yes, offer one last chance under very specific conditions for what's acceptable. Often people are so shocked by the estrangement that they actually are willing to change their behavior when a new chance is offered. So I would encourage people to think about that too. You aren't saying, I'm going to get back into this relationship exactly the way it was. You're saying, I'm willing to try this one more time, and here's the way it has to be, take it or leave it. A surprising number of the other people actually do take it, and it winds up working out.
You know, that reminds me when you say the part about, yeah, I'm not going to get into the relationship exactly as it was. Again, that parallel I see with couples who are trying to survive infidelity is a classic example of that. You're not going to go back to the relationship you had before, and you better not, because look where that led. So you're going to get into a relationship that's better than it was before, maybe different from what it was before. And when people can accept that, which is really an act of great faith, if they can say, okay, it's going to be viable here somehow, but it's not going to be what it was before. If they can accept that reality, then they can actually have a chance of moving forward. And when they can't, then they end up splitting up. And I think that's probably similar to scenarios of reconciliation.
Yeah, where you also say change your expectations. You know, you can change the person, but you can only change the way you react to them.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. It's extraordinary how many people continue to believe that at age 68, they're going to be able to change how their 70-year-old sister behaves. I mean, it's just so unlikely. And yet, it's the triumph of hope over experience or something. People keep insisting on these expectations. So I would say yes, for people who reconcile, very often they have high expectations which keep being dashed. And the way they restore the relationship is they do abandon a lot of the expectations. One classic example, which I'm sure many listeners have seen, does come around family caregiving, where someone, often a daughter who lives nearest by, becomes the primary caregiver for a parent, and the siblings just don't pitch in. And often in that case, there would be an estrangement. And the child would say, you know, I finally realized he just couldn't do it. He wasn't this kind of a person. And I never should have expected it of him. And I think that really is the situation. I mean, many people have these feelings about their parents. People want their parents to act in a certain and highly specific way, and they don't. And so they violate their expectations. I would say, though, that's one of the hardest things about reconciliation. Some of these other aspects can be overcome, but for a parent who has very strong, sometimes culturally endorsed views of how a child ought to behave, for example, or someone who believes that their sibling should always have their back and they don't, Reevaluating and dropping those expectations is one of the biggest challenges for people, I think. It's very hard to let go of those when we cherish, you know, these notions that we have. So I think, you know, that again is something that people can work through with a good therapist, is where am I being realistic in my expectations? You know, they'll find that someone just really didn't have anything to give and he's been that way his whole life and it was unrealistic to think about it. So, like, so that does emerge frequently.
One of the things I've noticed in clinical work is that when people are able to adjust their expectations, when they're able to recognize, you know, just as you point out in the book, you know, just because I think this is how a parent should act or this is how an adult child should act doesn't mean it's going to happen that way. When they are able to relax that in the interest of just having a relationship, ironically, people, when they're relaxed, often turn up the way you wanted them to turn up in the first place. And the thing that was getting in the way was the enormous amount of anxiety and anger and hard feeling between them. And once that is relaxed, then often people will come through in surprising ways.
Yeah, Bruce, I'd like to harken back too to something you said on that score. The one thing which I found in these studies that you alluded to, and it's also a part of Bowen theory, but one thing I found in these studies is that people attribute the estrangement. So if a parent's child is estranged from him or her, he or she will attribute it to anger, hostility, narcissism, where the underlying reason is much more likely to be anxiety.
Yeah.
The person becomes so anxious at the role they're forced into in the family, whether they're going to be criticized, whether their partner's going to be criticized, whether, you know, old feelings are going to come up, that the people who reconcile frequently in therapy deal with the anxiety they have about reentering the family. And in talking to estranged parents in particular, I found that they find that notion really helpful, that it's not necessarily that your kid hates you or is hostile towards you. It's that when the kid reenters the family, they become really, really anxious at what the family is making them and how it's making them see themselves. I think that notion can be a little bit liberating for people, that behind
Absolutely.
These estrangements, there's a lot of anxiety as much as there is anger or hostility.
That's often when I'm explaining that concept to folks, and often in a first session, actually, that's often a real eye-opener, the idea that, you know, the notion of intimacy requires tolerance of anxiety in ways that's often surprising to people. And people will often avoid it, like in a marriage, because it's too scary, because the other person's so important to them. They don't know how to tolerate the anxiety that comes with bridging those differences. And so that concept of needing, you know, that seven-word formula I talk, be kind, don't panic, and have faith. Don't panic is in the middle of it precisely because of that. You can't be kind if you're panicking. And the antidote to panic is faith, which is to say that essential acceptance that, you know, it's possible to have a relationship even if it isn't the way you thought it was going to be. You know, that's an element of faith, and that's what lets you not panic so you can tolerate the anxiety. And that in turn is what lets you be kin to someone, which is what I mean by being kind. So it really does fit that paradigm.
Yeah, no, I think your seven more, I think that are really an extremely useful way to sum up, you know, the concept of it. I think that's absolutely right. And I would say be kind too touches on this issue of imagining your relationship with this relative briefly for as long as you can stand it. Imagine it in the most charitable way possible. And that's why in the book I talk about a lot of the psychological research on perspective taking, which people find is very useful in any intergroup conflict. You know, this notion of writing about the situation from the other person's perspective, or if you can't bring yourself to do that, there's been a lot of research on a technique where you write about the situation or talk about it as if you were an objective third party trying to find the best solution for everybody in the relationship.
Yeah.
To the extent, because when we, as you know, I'm sure in your marriage work, if you're rejected by somebody, that in and of itself is so painful. You know, like, so it's very hard to imagine the perspective of the other person. And then your first impulse is to go and talk to like-minded people. I mean, look at the current election. People on both sides watching what's going on are running to whoever shares their opinion and getting solace, so that people develop a narrative that's based on this feeling of rejection, and then they seek out everybody else in the family, or they seek out their friends who don't know the other people, who aren't going to defend the other person. Right. So to the extent that you can, when you say be kind, I think of one way that that's enacted is do whatever you can to tell the story from the other person's perspective. I would ask people in my interviews who had never thought about this, imagine that your daughter is sitting with a friend at lunch and her friend asks her, why don't you have any contact with your mother? What would your daughter say? In most cases, people who were currently estranged had immense difficulty even beginning that dialogue. They had, or at best they'd say, oh, she'd just say I was a terrible old witch, you know, who knows? They had a tremendous difficulty even on the repeated, you know, questioning.
Yeah, because by the time they've reached that point of cutting off, it's the narratives are so hardened, it's very difficult to do that.
And then there's no contact, so you aren't seeing how the other person might be changing. So I think you have this kind of a complex, but I really like this notion of being kind is definitely one, if not the one thing people think of when they think of empathy is sympathy, but actually in psychological research on empathy, there's a cognitive dimension. It's the simple ability to be able to imagine the other person's emotional state. That gets so disrupted and estranged that it takes real work to then move your way back into it. And I think that's one of the major tasks. And people who reconcile, like again, almost invariably said, I could not do this until I looked at my own role, even if it wasn't a big role. I had to examine my own role in this to be able to reconcile.
Yeah. Well, Carl, thank you so much for doing this. This has just been delightful.
It was nice meeting both of you.
It was so nice to have you. And again, that's Carl Pillemer, whose book, Fault Lines, Fractured Families and How to Mend Them. It's just a wonderful book. I enjoyed reading it, Carl, and, you know, a lot of insight, and not just on estrangement, but, you know, just looking at relationships in families too, and not necessarily estranged family members, but, you know, even in your regular dealings with family members.
Thanks. It's been a pleasure to be here with you, and I feel like I've learned a lot as well. So many thanks for having me.
So I hope you enjoyed that interview with Dr. Carl Pillemer as much as we enjoyed having him on our program. And if you have questions that you would like us or some of our experts to answer, you can write to us at bruce@brucechalmer.com or visit brucechalmer.com.
And when you visit brucechalmer.com, if you go over to the podcast tab, that's where you can find, actually, you can listen to the podcast from there, or you can go to a page where even the earlier ones, there's only a certain number I noticed that show up on that page, but it'll take you to a page where you can find all of our podcasts going back to the beginning. And we would very much like you to suggest, as Judy said, suggest topic suggestions and ask us questions, because as you'll note in our interview, even when we don't have an interview guest, we like to handle a listener question in each episode. And you can even suggest someone, including yourself, to be a guest on our program. And we are always open to suggestions for that, because that's one of the most fun parts of doing this, is getting to talk to interesting people and share those talks with you. So, Judy, why don't you tell folks some of the topics we'll be doing in upcoming episodes?
Sure. We will be talking about infidelity and how to heal from it, how to know when to call it quits, and other topics, especially if you suggest them.
And so we want to just put in another plug here for the book, Reigniting the Spark, Why Stable Relationships Lose Intimacy and How to Get It Back. And just like we did in the beginning of this episode, we're going to let you in on a couple more of the wonderful reviews, you know, some excerpts from reviews that we've been getting. So Judy, why don't you go ahead and read the first one?
I was hooked on this book from the very first sample I read of it. I appreciated that Dr. Chalmer doesn't shy away from difficult topics like sex, trauma, and anxiety in relationships, and that he acknowledges the difficulties those situations present in maintaining relationships. I've even recommended this book to someone for precisely that reason. I really appreciated this book and am even implementing a few things into my own marriage.
Well, that was nice to read, and here's one more.
Happily married for 13 years, I wasn't sure what this book would offer to me and my spouse. As it turns out, quite a bit. I came to realize how easy it is to fall into complacency and relationship laziness to avoid conflict, and how that can lead to stagnation. Through the examples of many couples he has counseled, Dr. Chalmer explores constructive methods of resolving disagreements and enhancing communication. This book is not just for people in troubled situations, but for anyone who is seeking a higher level of satisfaction with their partner.
So if you get a hold of the book at Barnes & Noble or Amazon or your favorite bookstore, and you can get a hold of it in paper, you can get a hold of it for your ebook on a Kindle, you can get a hold of it as an audiobook. Whatever form you do, when you get a hold of it, maybe you can write a review and we would be happy to see it. You know, it's always great as an author to get feedback from our readers to let us know what they found meaningful in the book. So until next time,
remember, be kind,
don't panic,
and have faith.